Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere, like at your pregame barbecue. While you prep your meats, that grease trap you forgot to empty is prepping to smoke your porch, garage, and the car inside. And without the right home and auto insurance coverage, the cost to repair this could eat up your savings. So bundle home and auto with Allstate to save and get protected from mayhem like this. Bundled savings vary and are not available in every state. Coverage is subject to policy terms and conditions.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're gonna love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Carol G.
Juan Gabriel.
Christina Aguilera.
What do these three have in common?
You mean apart from impeccable style, chart-topping canciones, and drama?
Facts, yes, all of the above are correct, but most importantly, they're some of the biggest Latin icons in the world. And they're just a few of the game-changing Latin stars we're covering in Becoming an Icon Season 2. Listen to Becoming an Icon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Volume.
The 82-game preseason is in the books, and now it's finally time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered with same-game parlays, live betting, odds boosts, and so much more. The Boston Celtics are currently the favorite at plus 160, but the team that's third in my championship rankings, the Dallas Mavericks, you can get them on DraftKings right now at plus 1600 to win the title. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code HOOPS. That's H-O-O-P-S. New customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code HOOPS, H-O-O-P-S, only on DraftKings. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or in West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY to 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly on behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas. 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario, bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources. All right, welcome to Hoops Tonight here at The Volume. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Hope all of you guys are having a great week. Just going to go quick for about 15 minutes on that Lakers-Pelicans game, and then we're coming back live tonight after the final buzzer of Kings-Warriors on YouTube. So make sure you guys get over to YouTube after that game finishes. You guys know the drill. Before we get started, subscribe to our brand new YouTube channel so you don't miss any more of our videos. Follow me on Twitter at @_JasonLT so you guys don't miss any show announcements. Don't forget about our podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts, under Hoops Tonight. And then last but not least, keep dropping mailbag questions in the YouTube comments so we can hit them later on throughout the week. So as I said in the Sunday show, I was expecting more or less today's game to be ugly. It's really hard to beat a good team twice in a row, especially after you humiliate them. For the losing team, their pride is on the line. For the winning team, there's a natural sense of relaxation that comes in. And honestly, it was ugly for different reasons than I was expecting. I expected the Pelicans to kind of keep this game close throughout. The way it looked there in that first quarter was more or less kind of what I was expecting the game to look like. Pelicans get an early lead. Lakers kind of linger around and out-execute them late. To be honest, I was generally impressed by the Lakers in this game and the way that they kind of controlled and dominated things throughout. And really, it was more or less just like what happened in the Sunday game. They went up big and then they relaxed, and the Pelicans brought a bunch of ball pressure and speed onto the table and were able to kind of make things a little more competitive. Just in this particular game, the Pelicans made it super competitive and actually tied the game, I think, at 1 or 2 points. So it was ugly, but in a different way than I was expecting. The early success for New Orleans, couple specific things, bringing the force. That's the big pendulum that swings an NBA playoff series is force. Usually the team that wins game one, you go into game two, you can expect the team that lost game one to bring more force, and typically the team that won game one to bring less force. What is force? It's just doing everything harder. Cutting harder, screening harder, running in transition both ways harder, driving harder. Every element of the game, usually the team that's playing with more force is bringing that effort and intensity to a higher level. That's that pendulum that swings, and that pendulum swung a big way in the Pelicans' direction. Well, a couple of schematic things. They were using screens on Zion more often. So a lot of what Zion does offensively is they just set him up in that slot there on the right wing, and they space the floor, and he'll just go straight ISO. That didn't work against LeBron because LeBron has Zion's number in a lot of ways. And I thought LeBron did a really good job on Zion again in this game. But they used screens to get Zion onto other players, whether it was Rui or Anthony Davis. He was going through Anthony Davis like he was tissue paper. And then also in the stretches where LeBron was off the floor, so like late first quarter, late third quarter, Zion was super aggressive to try to take advantage of those particular stretches, which was a big part of how the Pelicans dominated those stretches of the game. Also in that fourth quarter run, another big part of what helped the Pelicans kind of get back into it is the Lakers were chasing Jose Alvarado over the top of ball screens, which they probably shouldn't have been doing. Jose Alvarado shot 33% on pull-up jump shots this year, and he wasn't shooting particularly well in this game. I would have ducked underneath picks. That would have shut that action off. Instead, D'Angelo Russell was chasing Jose Alvarado over the top. Jose Alvarado was getting into the lane, engaging Anthony Davis, and dropping the ball off for Larry Nance, who was getting dunks and layups right at the rim. So that was kind of a schematic mistake from Darvin Ham that I thought kind of led to a big part of New Orleans' late success. But again, late in the game, and obviously Zion getting injured played a certain factor here, but they did get a couple of buckets after that. But the Lakers just kind of settled down offensively, got a few great looks. One of the consistent problems for the Pelicans in this matchup is they can't play Jonas Valanciunas. So when Jonas Valanciunas comes out, Anthony Davis just has a huge size advantage underneath the basket. I think he had 6 or 7 offensive rebounds in this game. And on one of the key possessions late, Anthony Davis got an offensive rebound and got to the foul line and knocked down a couple of big free throws. But bottom line, late in the game, it's LeBron James against Herb Jones. He gets a bucket. It's I don't remember exactly what the action was, but the Lakers drew a double team. Worked it around. I think it was LeBron drew a double team. Lakers worked it around, and it ended up with a wide open catch and shoot three for D'Angelo Russell. Like, the Lakers were just gonna get better shots down the stretch. That was more or less what I expected from the ugliness of the game, is it would be ugly, then the Lakers would get better shots down the stretch and win. People don't realize this, but the Lakers were the best clutch team in basketball this year. They went 24-9 in games that were within 5 minutes and within 5 points late in the game. And so they've been pretty consistently great at doing that, just getting a couple of key stops and getting a couple of key buckets and getting out of there with the win. So the Lakers get it done. Again, it was ugly, but like, you know, a couple big swing factors there. I thought Anthony Davis had one of those games where he just kind of doesn't have it. I don't know whether it was the back spasms or if it's just one of those things that AD can do sometimes, but he just was generally kind of floating through the game on both ends of the floor for three quarters. Did make a couple of big plays in the fourth. He had a big offensive rebound putback. Then he got a block on CJ McCollum at the rim. Obviously drew the foul on the offensive glass late, so made some big plays, but AD was pretty disengaged. And between AD being pretty bad and Zion being pretty awesome, that was enough to give the Pelicans a chance to win, but alas, it was not enough. I want to shout out LeBron James because I thought this was a classic example of dominating a game without making shots. He was 6-for-20, tricked off a bunch of layups, barely made any jump shots aside from the big one that he hit over Herb Jones late. It was a rough shot-making game for him, and yet I thought he completely dominated every facet of the game. First of all, the defense on Zion. When he was on Zion, they had him under control. It was generally when he got off of Zion, whether it was transition cross matches, transition situations where he was helping somewhere else off the ball, or when they were screening him to get Anthony Davis into the action, that Zion had some impact. But LeBron blew up a bunch of plays in the passing lanes. He was a great rebounder in this particular game, got a bunch of key contested defensive rebounds. And then on the offensive end of the floor, generated just a ton of high-quality shots. And then a big one, I thought, was just his timely play in the key stretches of the game. The Pelicans blow it open to end the third. Then LeBron comes in the second quarter, just immediately takes control of the game, gets it back to the Lakers being in front. That actually led to the Lakers kind of dominating that second quarter. Pelicans go on a big run in the third quarter. LeBron comes in the early fourth and immediately kind of helps reassert control when he gets in there. I thought he was great in the key stretches, great in the key areas of the game, despite going 6-for-20. So shout out to LeBron. Lakers Nuggets. Again, like I said, after the Sunday game, different teams this year, this time around. I think the Nuggets are actually a little better than they were last year, and I think the Lakers are a little better than they were last year. The Nuggets have some of that defending champion type of swagger. Peyton Watson, I think, has brought a real element to their bench defense. I think everybody in the starting lineup is a little better than they were last year. But on the Lakers front, LeBron, this is not LeBron with the bad foot. This is LeBron who's been playing. I tweeted this out during the game, but LeBron post All-Star break has been a top three player in the league. Literally. It's been basically Jokic, Luka, and LeBron that have been the best players in the league post All-Star break. And that's like a fourth of the season. He's been the only guy in the league post All-Star break to average at least 27 points per game on at least 50% from the field and at least 40% from three. They've been dominant when he's on the floor and terrible when he's off the floor. LeBron's been at a higher level. Anthony Davis is more or less the same player he was last year, although he's been a little better handling post-up double teams. Obviously, the Lakers' offense is more polished with their five-out sets. The Nuggets don't do as much switching as the Pelicans do, and as I talked about in my contenders list, the Lakers can be a little susceptible to switching defenses. That was part of what made them go so stagnant. Now, the Lakers are capable of beating switching with LeBron and AD in size, but specifically with the Pelicans, that was a big part of how they kind of let go of the rope. Lakers went up 18. Then that Nance lineup at center, they started switching everything. The Lakers got stagnant. They started to take some bad shots. That's how you play the Lakers into their worst tendencies. And so I actually expect the Lakers to score more effectively against the Nuggets in this series than they did last year. But all of that said, Denver is the better team. I'm going to start my prep on that series tomorrow. We'll probably have that breakdown with some film up later in the day tomorrow. But the last thing is, for the Lakers to have any chance to beat the Nuggets, they need Anthony Davis to be great. He got his ass kicked by Nikola Jokic last year. Pretty bad, too. To the point where in Game 4 in particular, when their backs were against the wall, I thought AD looked a little bit disengaged and a little bit like he let go of the rope. Like, so Jokic kicked his butt so bad that AD kind of let go of the rope a little bit last year. That's going to be the factor that needs to swing back the other direction. Anthony Davis, he doesn't need to outplay Jokic, but he needs to get up to that level. And then LeBron James does need to outplay Jamal Murray. That's their only chance. I was kind of disappointed in AD tonight for such a big game for him to be as ineffective as he was, but he can make up for it by going in there on Saturday or Sunday, whenever the game is, and getting a big win in Denver. I think the Lakers need to win game one to win that series, just to kind of maintain their confidence and belief in their ability to win. But I have big expectations for AD in this one. He's got to show me something. It's something that I think he has an opportunity here to kind of reverse some of the narrative that surrounds him after that series. Because we went away from that series like, oh, Jokic is just way, 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 way better than AD. This isn't even much of a matchup. AD's got to make that a conversation for the Lakers to have a chance to win this series. And then lastly, before we get out of here, the Pelicans. I know it's disappointing to lose two straight games like this to end the season, but I think that this actually is shaping up pretty nicely for them. They match up extremely well with Sacramento. They're 5-0 this year. They match up extremely well with Golden State. They're 2-1 against them this year, and they've won two straight somewhat convincingly. You're going to have that game at home. Beat those teams, whoever comes out of that, right? The Oklahoma City Thunder are a team that initiate offense with a couple of guys that are 6'6 or shorter from the perimeter. That plays directly into the Pelicans' strength of their roster, which is perimeter defenders. And the Pelicans do not have the interior size, the Thunder do not have the interior size to punish the weak Pelicans front line defensively. I will pick Oklahoma City to win that series, but the Pelicans have a much better chance of beating the Thunder than they do to beat the Nuggets. So as disappointing as this is, as long as Zion can get back onto the floor in time, I actually think the Pelicans are kind of slotting into a pathway here that makes more sense for them. All right, guys, that is all I have for this particular video. Again, I will be back live on YouTube after the final buzzer of Kings Warriors. I will see you guys then.
Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere, like at your pregame barbecue. While you prep your meats, that grease trap you forgot to empty is prepping to smoke your porch, garage, and the car inside. And without the right home and auto insurance coverage, the cost to repair this could eat up your savings. So bundle home and auto with Allstate to save and get protected from mayhem like this. Bundled savings vary and are not available in every state. Coverage is subject to policy terms and conditions.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
All right, welcome to Hoops Tonight here at The Volume. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Hope all of you guys are having a great week so far. We're going to be breaking down the Warriors dynasty, potentially ending at the hands of the Sacramento Kings in the play-in game, the 9-10 play-in game. For those of you guys looking for a breakdown of Lakers-Pelicans, we actually already recorded that, and it's already uploaded, so you can find that a little bit further back in the feed. Just going to talk a little bit of Kings off the top. I don't really view them as a threat after this point. They're 0-5 versus the Pelicans this year. Obviously, Zion being out potentially with a hamstring is going to be somewhat of an issue, but it's more of the Pelicans' perimeter players that give them a bother. We're going to talk a little bit about the Warriors, some of the things that stood out from this season, and part of the reason why I was never really optimistic about them making a run to begin with, where the Warriors should go from here. And then at the end, I personally just want to pay a little bit of a homage to the Warriors just for what it was like rooting, obviously, as someone who's a fan of LeBron James and had to root against them a lot over the years, just how incredible that dynasty was, how, you know, relentless they were in their pursuit of winning and how inevitable they felt at times. And I put down four of my favorite moments after KD left, and just kind of like my appreciation for the Warriors. That's going to be at the end of the show. You guys know the drill before we get started. Subscribe to our brand new YouTube channel so you don't miss any more of our videos. Follow me on Twitter at @_JasonLT so you guys don't miss show announcements, as well as the film threads that I do from time. Don't forget about our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts under Hoops Tonight. It's also super helpful if you leave a rating and a review on that front. And last but not least, keep leaving mailbag questions in the YouTube comments so we can keep hitting them throughout the rest of this week. All right, let's talk some basketball. So this was just a complete and total beatdown at the hands of the Sacramento Kings. They outshot the Warriors from the field. They outshot the Warriors from three. They shot better from the foul line. They doubled them up on the offensive glass. They had more assists with fewer turnovers. They had twice as many steals, twice as many fast break points, and committed fewer fouls. It was just a complete and total outclassing. Honestly, I was a little disappointed just with how the Warriors held up physically, because for all of the weaknesses that the Warriors have, things like interior size, things like shot creation, one of their strengths is they're actually a really athletic team, especially on the wing. They've got a lot of youthful exuberance at some key positions and a lot of length and athleticism, especially on the perimeter. That should, in theory, allow them to match up pretty well with Sacramento, but they just didn't hold up tonight for whatever reason. Obviously, the veterans in particular struggled in this game, but some of the young guys too, even though their effort shined through, some of their execution stuff that you expect from young players to struggle with, that kind of shined through to the surface as well. It was just a complete and total dominating performance from the Sacramento Kings. I want to shout out two specific guys. First is Keegan Murray. He literally looked like the old Klay Thompson out there. He was defending a quick guard extremely well, right? We've seen Klay do that to a bunch of quick guards over the year, namely Kyrie Irving, over the course of their matchups in the playoffs over the years. And hidden threes, not just in volume, not in different spots on the floor, but also just flying off of screens, kind of like we're accustomed to seeing from Klay Thompson. Honestly, Keegan hit 8 threes in this game. Honestly, like, I have to kind of eat a little bit of crow here, in the sense that, like, when Keegan Murray got drafted and after watching him play in the NBA last year, I was, you know, appreciative of him as a good role player in this league, but I didn't really think he had this kind of upside as a perimeter defender. I didn't think he had this kind of upside as a movement shooter. I have to kind of reevaluate my personal kind of like view of Keegan Murray's ceiling with some of the stuff that he's shown this season. And this was just a big time performance from him in a super, super important game. Honestly, like, for all the criticism of the play-in tournament that we've seen over the years, that was an intense game. You had two really good teams playing in a single elimination game. You just don't get that in the NBA very often. Typically, the 9-10 game, even in the Western Conference over the years, has been the lesser of the teams that we've seen. It's usually the 7-8 game where we'll see the good teams. And some of this is just the realities of the Western Conference. There are 10 good teams in the West, right? Like, I'll give you guys an example. I think the Lakers and Clippers are both clearly top 6 teams in the NBA. I had the Lakers at 6 in my contender rankings, and I had the Clippers at 4, if I remember correctly. So, like, Lakers and Clippers, for me, both top 6 championship contenders. I'm going to be picking them both to lose in the first round of the playoffs. Why? Because they're playing two teams that are in the top 3 of my championship contenders. The Western Conference is just completely stacked. And so, unfortunately, as a product of that, the Warriors and Kings fall down into the 9-10 game. They have to play a single elimination game. Somebody's got to go home. It ends up being the Golden State Warriors. But shout out to Keegan Murray, because in such a big game, for him to show up the way he did, that tells you a lot about the type of potential that he has in the big picture. Keon Ellis is the second guy. You guys who remember last year in the postseason, I talked a lot about how De'Aaron Fox and Malik Monk, to a certain extent, but De'Aaron Fox mainly, demonstrated that, like, he could really defend the guard position. He's capable of it. It's just a lot to ask for your primary shot-creating star to defend the other team's best guard, right? And so you'd see a lot of, like, Davion Mitchell, but Davion Mitchell had some offensive limitations, and they just didn't have an option that they could go to that they could consistently get high-quality perimeter defense while also getting the ability to consistently knock down an open shot while also not having to ask De'Aaron Fox to do it. Because if you have to ask De'Aaron Fox to do it, you're paying the price on the other end of the floor. Keon Ellis has been that for the Kings this year. He can really, really defend the best guards in the league while also being a knockdown shooter and also take that off of De'Aaron Fox's workload. And I thought, you know, Mike Brown actually talked about it after the third quarter in his interview, basically just talking about, like, hey, like, being able to switch things up on Steph and go from length and size to kind of like speed and quickness with Keon Ellis, it was a way that they could kind of keep Steph off balance. And I thought he did a really nice job. And as I've talked about all season long, with the Warriors, if you can do a good job on Steph, you're probably going to win, because there's nobody else on that team that can consistently generate high-quality shots. They held Steph to 22 points. They forced him into 6 turnovers. Then they dominated every other facet of the game and got the win. Here's the problem, though. Sacramento is a team that just brings perimeter defender after perimeter defender after perimeter defender after perimeter defender. De'Aaron Fox is going to be seeing Herb Jones. He's going to be seeing Dyson Daniels. He's going to be seeing length and athleticism on him for the entire game. And they just have a plethora of that type of talent on the floor. And they press the they press the ball handlers, they play passing lanes, they force turnovers, they get out in transition. They're 5-0 against the Sacramento Kings this year. And again, Zion Williamson pulled his hamstring at the end of the Lakers game tonight, so maybe that'll give them a little bit of a semblance of a route that they can go. But the Pelicans, you know, when they take Zion out, they play a little bit more drive and kick, but they can still be actually better defensively than they are with Zion on the floor. Obviously, they're just going to kind of default more to running things through Brandon Ingram and CJ McCollum, but I still think the Pelicans are going to get that win on Friday just on the strength of their perimeter defense. Either way, though, I don't think either of those teams have much of a chance against Oklahoma City, even if they're better matchups than some of the other teams in the West that they can face. So really impressive win for the Kings, but without Malik Monk, even if they do survive the Pelicans game, I don't think they have the horses to make any sort of substantial playoff run. So moving on to the Warriors, there's going to be a lot of talk about Draymond Green and the way his suspension kind of put them in this predicament. I think they were 33-22 this year when Draymond actually played, which is pretty solid, right? And I want to be clear, there's truth to that. Like, Draymond Green did put his team in a predicament where they dropped a bunch of games, and maybe, just maybe, they're not in the 9-10 game if Draymond plays the entire season. However, I never really saw the Warriors as a team that was capable of winning multiple playoff rounds. Maybe, just maybe, if they got like the Thunder in the first round, a really young team, or maybe like the Minnesota Timberwolves, who can struggle to execute in the half court, like maybe the Warriors could get a playoff round underneath their belt, but I didn't view them as a substantial threat in the West this year. And the main reason why was they weren't very good against the good teams in the league. Like, this season, they were 23-4 against teams in the bottom 10 in point differential, which was the seventh best mark in the league, but they were just 9-21 versus teams that are in the top 10 in point differential this year. That's 20th. In the NBA. They consistently, when they ran up against the real teams at the top of the league, they just didn't have the shot creation. And that was really it. And some of it kind of comes down to two things. First of all, the team's fatal flaw: they didn't have another guy on the roster who could consistently generate high quality offense. Like, Kuminga had a hot stretch. You know, you get a hot stretch at Andrew Wiggins at some point, you get a hot stretch out of Klay Thompson at some point. But in any one game sample, when you were going in as a Warriors fan or going in as someone who watches the Warriors a lot, you were sitting there thinking, like, is Klay going to play well tonight? Maybe. Is Andrew Wiggins going to play well tonight? Maybe. Is Jonathan Kuminga going to play well tonight? Maybe. There wasn't a legit guy next to Steph that you could depend on to consistently generate high-quality offense. Basically, everybody in the Western Conference has that. Sacramento, before the Malik Monk injury, you knew you had that with Malik Monk. Obviously, LeBron James, it's kind of by committee with AD, Austin Reeves, and D'Angelo Russell, right? Obviously, the New Orleans Pelicans, it's Brandon Ingram, Zion Williamson, and it's CJ McCollum, right? You go to the Suns, it's KD, Bradley Beal, Devin Booker. You go to the Clippers, it's James Harden, it's Kawhi Leonard, it's Paul George, it's Luka Doncic, and it's Kyrie Irving. It's Jamal Murray, and it's Nikola Jokic. The Warriors, really, aside from the injury to Malik Monk, they were the only team in the Western Conference that did not have a legitimate threat that could consistently generate quality shots beyond Steph Curry. And then to make matters worse, Steph just hasn't been the same player over the course of the last third of the season. And this kind of really colors things when we start to talk about where the Warriors should go from here. Steph's 25 games to end the season, 22.8 points per game, 4.5 rebounds per game, 5.5 assists per game, 41.9% from the field, 37.5% from three. That's Steph's last 25 games of the season. And then you saw him tonight really struggling to break free from Keegan Murray and to break free from Keon Ellis. A lot of sloppy turnovers, just struggling to kind of get to his spots, right? And so there's a bunch of factors there. My guess is he's probably a little banged up. Wouldn't be surprised if in the next couple of days we hear some sort of report of an injury that Steph Curry's been dealing with. Because, like, even in decline, and we're going to talk about that, even in decline, shouldn't happen this dramatically this quickly, right? Two, yeah, Steph getting a little older, small guard. There's going to be some decline there. You're starting to see that. And then three, when you don't have legitimate, reliable shot creation off of your star, it allows teams to throw the kitchen sink at Steph Curry. By the way, this is a big part of why I'm not as high on the New York Knicks as everyone else. Love the New York Knicks in the long run. But without Julius Randle, they do not have a legitimate secondary shot creator next to Jalen Brunson. As a result, they're 7-17 this year against teams that are in the top 10 in point differential. I do not think they're going to be able to beat the teams with the high firepower for the exact same reason. When you have one guy, you can throw the kitchen sink at it, and chances are you'll figure out a way to rotate on the back end to kind of contain some of those more limited offensive players. And so, like, that's really where things fell apart for the Warriors this year. Honestly, like, you know, and I talked about this during Jonathan Kuminga's rise. We had that stretch there. Like, Jonathan Kuminga had never had two consecutive 20-point games in his career. And then he rips off eight of them in a row, right? And you're like, holy shit, this guy might be a future star. By the way, I still kind of feel like he's going to be. I don't think he's on the trajectory with, like, Anthony Edwards and, like, the super, super stars that we have that are the young players in the league. But, like, I think he could be kind of in that Jaylen Brown level guy that's in the 15 to 20th best player in the league, who's like a legit 25 point per game guy who can really defend. I think that's in Kuminga's potential, right? And so he flashed all that to potential, and then all of a sudden trading guys was just out of the window, right? Like, going into that stretch, you're like, trade Kuminga, trade some draft picks. Maybe you go after a Pascal Siakam. Maybe you go after an OG Anunoby. And then as Kuminga started to play better, right as OG Anunoby and Pascal Siakam were off, the trade talks were heating up, they go off. Kuminga playing well kind of removes him from that equation. All of a sudden, they're out of the Siakam, OG Anunoby sweepstakes. Now, all of a sudden, you're kind of trapped with this particular group, right? And I talked consistently during that time. You Warriors fans that follow the show, you'll remember this. I said consistently during that time, like, this is great for the future, but do not count on these young guys to be reliable shot creators when you get to big time playoff games. And that's what this was. This was a big time playoff game. And Kuminga made some plays tonight, played really hard. I thought he had a good stretch there in the first half, but, like, was he consistently generating quality shots in this game? No, because he's young. He's too young for that type of game. And he's not polished enough with his handle and to get to his spots and to read the floor to do that. Will he in 5 years? Probably. Think that's on the table. Not just on the table, it's probably likely for Jonathan Kuminga in a 5-year timeline. But the minute you decided, we're not going all in, we're sticking with these guys, you capped off this team. And the championship ceiling was out the window. I threw them 10th, tied with the Heat in my contender rankings, just as a sign of respect towards Steph Curry and Jimmy Butler. But, you know, the Warriors just don't have the firepower. They don't have the firepower to hang in these types of games. Like, they could have beat the Kings tonight. I'm not trying to act like they can't beat the Kings. Of course they could beat the Kings tonight. They needed to hold up better physically. They needed more out of Klay, and they needed Steph to play like a superstar. Instead, they didn't hold up physically. Klay gave you nothing, and Steph played like he's been playing for the last third of the season. And as a result, they got basically dog walked tonight, right? And so, like, that's kind of the reality of the predicament that they're in. And so, you know, where do we go from here? You could make an all-in trade, right? Like, you could try to go after a star, maybe a Paul George, maybe a Brandon Ingram if the Pelicans decide to kind of change their build this summer. You can go in that sort of direction, but you have to take a look at your situation here. Like, Steph's last 25 games, how much of that is decline versus not playing alongside a star? You take a gamble. You go after a star. Let's say you get Paul George, but you have to give up Kuminga, you have to give up draft compensation. Let's say Steph just isn't a top 10 player next year. If that happens, then all of a sudden now you don't have the draft assets and the young talent to kind of slide into the next phase of your future. You just have an old Steph and an old Paul George, right? And so that's where it gets tricky. Like, I almost feel like if you were going to do that, you needed to do it last year. You needed to do it the year after they won the title. That was the year where it made sense. Steph was still playing at that level. A lot of those guys, the young guys, were mostly just kind of, just prospects at that point. They didn't have that sort of long-term potential, that, or at least we hadn't seen it really manifest for Jonathan Kuminga yet. That was where it made sense to do it. Now it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And, like, who were the guys that kind of came in and brought the energy tonight when the Warriors came out flat? It was Moses Moody. It was Brandon Podziemski. It was Jonathan Kuminga, right? And it's because they have the athletic tools to kind of hang in those sorts of settings, right? So, like, I think honestly, like, if I was running the Warriors at this point, I would just kind of read the writing on the wall. Like, if you can work out some sort of team-friendly deal for Klay and he wants to stay because he likes his living situation and he likes this team, you work it out. But if he gets offered a chunk of money and he wants to go, you let him go. You know, you see if you can make some moves on the margins. I don't know if you can use a draft pick and maybe one of the younger players or maybe using Chris Paul's salary to try to bring in some sort of piece to kind of bring in some firepower. But I don't think you mortgage the future anymore for this group. I think what you do is you bring, obviously, Steph and Draymond back. You bring a legitimate center in so that you can play a center next to Draymond to give yourself a better chance of holding up in terms of size. And then you lean into the youth next year. I think you probably start, you know, either Moses Moody and Jonathan Kuminga or Andrew Wiggins and Jonathan Kuminga. You lean heavily into Jonathan Kuminga as a shot creator and try to get him to build that out. And you don't worry as much about where you're at in the standings. You just work on development and work towards the future. But like, again, like I think the reality is that the championship ceiling is gone with this group. The championship ceiling with this group was Steph is a top five player. You make a trade to bring in a legitimate secondary star. They never did that. Now Steph has declined. Now the young guys are coming up. That's the direction you have to look to go from here. And I guess, honestly, it's going to be about whether or not Steph is willing to kind of be a part of a soft rebuild like that. My guess is Steph loves it in Golden State so much and that he's so integral to that franchise that he's not going anywhere. And to be honest, as much as I'd love to see Steph compete for a championship again someday, I just can't even fathom seeing him in another jersey. And so I think more likely than not that he ends up kind of riding off into the sunset gracefully as a member of the Golden State Warriors during a soft rebuild. But the only way a championship ceiling is coming back is if Jonathan Kuminga takes a 5-year leap over the summer. And I just don't really see that as an option. And or maybe they can, you know, nail some stuff over the course of the summer to kind of polish some things up on the roster. But the reality is it's a firepower issue with this team. They just never had consistently that secondary option next to Steph. So before we get out of here tonight, I just wanted to kind of talk a little bit about the Warriors dynasty from just purely from a fan perspective. So as I've told you guys before, I am a LeBron James fan. And obviously now it's much more of like a grown-up fanhood, right? Like LeBron fans hate me because I'm critical of him when he doesn't play well because I do a job to cover the NBA and talk about, you know, these basketball games and actually give X's and O's analysis, right? Obviously at this phase of my career, it's different. But like, you know, when I was during the Warriors dynasty, like I was in my mid-20s and I was, you know, like a young emotional fan who loved LeBron, loved that Cavaliers team. And I had to root against the Warriors. And man, did that suck. You know, like not even just the KD years, because the KD years were all about, you know, second and third best player in the world teaming up. And the Cavs just never really had a chance. But like going back to the 2015 year, watching Steph light up Matthew Dellavedova in game 5, I thought Steph got absolutely robbed of the finals MVP that year. All you had to do was have a basic understanding of the way the game of basketball works to understand that he was the reason everything was working for the Warriors down the stretch of that series, but it is what it is. Obviously the 2016 year, it's a little bit of Steph being hurt. It's a little bit of LeBron James and Kyrie Irving just meeting an insane level. But I have four moments after KD left the Warriors. Well, actually one of them's without KD, but in his last season with the Warriors, that just kind of, to me, encapsulated what made this Warriors dynasty so great. First was the 2019 series, the series against the Toronto Raptors. So obviously Kevin Durant goes down with the calf injury in the second round, and Golden State ends up sweeping the Portland Trailblazers without Kevin Durant and come back from huge deficits in all four games. Just a reminder of just how good Steph, Klay, and Draymond were when they were at their best. Like, KD made them unbeatable. But even without KD, they were still a top-tier contender in the league. They just probably wouldn't have, you know, they probably get one of those two instead of two of those two, right? Like, that's what I always say is, like, I think if KD doesn't go to Golden State, LeBron gets one of them in 2017, 2018, and Steph gets one of them in 2017, 2018. Instead, KD went there, so they got them both, right? But like, I think a lot of times we use the KD stuff to kind of underplay just how good Steph, Klay, and Draymond were. And like that game five, the game, was it game five? Yeah, it was game five, where Kawhi Leonard just went on that crazy haymaker spree to get, I think the Raptors went up by like six at that point in the game. And then Steph and Klay just stole that game with shot making. And I remember sitting there thinking, like, these dudes are just winners, man. Like, KD literally tore his Achilles in that game. If I remember correctly, I believe it was that game. KD hurts himself. You're on the ropes. Kawhi's on a shot making spree. It all looks like it's over. You're on the road. And Steph and Klay just refused to lose. And they got it done. And even then, if I remember correctly, in game six, Steph had a little step back jump shot on the right wing that could have tied it. So like they just didn't go down without a fight. I thought that was a great example of the winning character of the Warriors. 2021 play-in game. Obviously, you have no Klay Thompson in that game. If I remember correctly, I think that Andrew Wiggins was on that team. But once again, like that was the Lakers when they still had all their athleticism, right? That was when they still had Alex Crusoe and they still had Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. Like that was a very, very good Lakers team. And Steph just played absurdly well and literally pushed them to the brink. And then LeBron basically hit the game winner when he got poked in the eye. But like there's a moment in that game, and you Warriors fans will probably remember this. You Lakers fans will definitely remember this. But there was a moment in that game where the Lakers went on a little run in the fourth quarter. And the camera pans over to Steph on the sideline. And after the Lakers made their run, because Steph obviously sits to start the fourth quarter, you just see this moment where Steph just kind of nods and he just goes like, all right, let's go. We got ourselves a game here. And I remember watching it being like, this motherfucker is going to check back into the game and immediately reassert himself. And he checked back in the game and the Warriors immediately regained control. And like that stretch there, that 2021, 2022, 2023 stretch from Steph was so much fun because I actually think that was the best version of Steph. I know a lot of Steph fans disagree with me, but I just thought he was at such a level defensively. A lot of times people forget, like around 2016 when Steph won the unanimous MVP, Steph was barbecuing traditional coverages and a lot of teams just didn't know how to handle Steph yet. As a matter of fact, the Cavs blitzing him in the 2015 finals, that was kind of like the first team that really started doing that and doing it effectively like they did in that series, although Steph ended up solving it. Like the idea of the way you guard Steph Curry didn't really come to fruition until the end of the 2010s. And like Steph was barbecuing the best defensive coverages to deal with a player like him in that 2021, 2022, 2023 stretch. I just thought he was at an insanely high level. Obviously, the 2022 playoff run. What's crazy with that one is like Steph's a rhythm player, like every other kind of like perimeter shooter in the league, right? And he went into that playoff run on a foot injury and came off the bench to start the Denver series. And then ended up with one of the best playoff games I've ever seen from an individual player in that game four in Boston, just kind of backpacking the Warriors on their way to the title. And like, it was similar to like the Denver Nuggets in the sense that like there wasn't like a bona fide superstar next to Steph, but he was getting a lot of big time contributions from big time players, right? Like obviously Klay Thompson did an unbelievable job defensively in that series on Jaylen Brown. You got the Jordan Poole playoff run. You get the Andrew Wiggins playoff run. Like they got some contributions. Again, no team wins a championship without help. But Steph was just unbelievable in that playoff run. And then 2023, 50 points in game seven on the road against the Sacramento Kings. And then in that 2023 second round playoff series, watching that chess match between Steve Kerr and Darvin Ham surrounding the Anthony Davis, Steph Curry problem for both teams. And I, you know, it's funny, this summer I went back and I rewatched that series. And those of you guys who actually watched the show over the summer, you probably remember me doing a show about this, but like Steph, no matter what the Lakers threw at him in that series, Steph just controlled things in ball screens. It was crazy. I can't remember the exact numbers because I pulled him over the summer, but the Lakers were throwing the kitchen sink at him. And he just continued to get and generate quality shots every single time down the floor, no matter what coverage they used. Really, the only reason the Lakers escaped that series was at the end of game four, Lonnie Walker hit a bunch of pull-up jump shots, and then Anthony Davis switched onto Steph Curry, which was the ultimate kind of like final move that the Lakers had in their back pocket, and Anthony Davis got a couple of stops on an island, and that was pretty much it. But like that entire series, I can just tell you as a fan, as someone who was rooting against Steph and rooting for LeBron in that series, like, I felt helpless. And again, that's what I remember about the Golden State dynasty is like when they were healthy, when Steph was at his A game, when Klay and Draymond were out there, when they had a legitimate two-way wing, whether it was Wiggins, whether it was Barnes, whether it was Kevin Durant, they were just inevitable. They were the best team of that particular era, in my opinion. And if this ends up being it, and I still think the Warriors will be interesting over the course of the next few years just because they've got some young talent. They got a great home crowd and they do have Steph Curry. And I still think Steph Curry's, you know, top 15, top 10 player in the league, right? So like there's going to be some fun times over the next few years, but salute to those guys. It's been a hell of a run. It's been a decade of dominance, four championships, got close in 2019 and 2016 as well. One of the great teams in NBA history, and it's been an honor to get to cover them and to get to watch them as a fan. And, you know, that's kind of why I talk, you know, how excited I am about the Nuggets. They feel to me like the next great team, the next great dynasty of this era. All right. That's all I have for tonight. As always, I sincerely appreciate you guys for supporting the show. I'll be back tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning I'm going to start my prep. We'll see when I actually get it uploaded, but I'm going to start with a series preview of Lakers Nuggets, and then we'll do a series preview of the Eastern Conference 7-2 matchup probably on Thursday. And then we'll see. I'm trying to think of what we're going to do on Friday. Probably going to have the Nerd Sesh guys on. And then obviously on Saturday morning, we'll have the 1-8 matchup previews. And then we'll get into our playoff grind. And so we're here, man. This is it. Night one of the playoffs in the books. I appreciate you guys. I will see you tomorrow.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio, Season 9.
Love at first listen.
We're older, we're wiser, and we're podcasting through a new decade of our lives.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
And getting to the heart of our stories.
We're going places we've never gone before, and we're bringing you along with us.
With new segments, correspondence, and a brand new sound.
Season 9 is kicking off with an intimate interview with Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Natalia Lafourcade. What's giving you hope right now?
Well, when I see what music does to people, it gives me a lot of hope.
If you liked Locatora before, you're going to love Season 9.
Subscribe to our show and you'll see why Locatora is your prima's favorite podcast.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Tura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Carol G.
Juan Gabriel.
Christina Aguilera.
What do these three have in common?
You mean apart from impeccable style, chart-topping canciones, and drama?
Facts, yes, all of the above are correct, but most importantly, they're some of the biggest Latin icons in the world. And they're just a few of the game-changing Latin stars we're covering in Becoming an Icon Season 2. Listen to Becoming an Icon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.